I hold myself in contempt if you try to pull me up here to court with that attorney.
The questions here, carjacker Willie.
Objection.
I'm going to allow it. It characterizes the defendant as a carjacker.
You didn't kill Thompson, but you did, Mr. Wells.
Yes, I killed Ned Thompson. I killed him.
Order. You're out of order. The whole trial is out of order. They're out of order.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
And welcome to Opening Arguments. This is a don't change that dial. Check, I don't know what the proper phrase is. This is a bonus episode coming at you at a weird time and place, not the norm, but there's just too much. I'm Thomas Smith. That over there is Andrew Torres. How are you doing, Andrew?
I am fantastic. I'm really, really excited. There are a bunch of things I wanted to cover, and the world blew up on Thursday on our record day. And rather than lose these down the whiteboard memory hole, maybe forever, I'm excited about getting them out to the people.
Me too. There's just too much. There's, you know, the one way recurring theme is how to deal with how negative the news is all the time. And I think maybe one positive way to deal with it is for more opening arguments. That's really, let's face it, I mean, that's the best shine on all this. So there you go.
Well, there you go.
In that spirit, let's see, what are we going to talk about? Roy Moore announcing?
We can riff about that for a little bit.
Should we talk about Biden wanting an apology for saying that segregationists were nice from Booker, who said maybe they weren't nice? Should we talk about that? What a great presidential candidate he is. No. Okay, I'm just going over all the other stuff that blew up today that that's not even on your list of stuff you were going to talk about. And we're not even going to talk about going to war with Iran, which I'm sure eventually there will be a lot of segments on that. No, it's other stuff. It's stuff we didn't get to. It's cheery stuff like whether or not they're detainment centers or concentration camps or something like that. So let's get into it. What happy news have you for us today, Andrew?
Well, this first segment is not what I would call happy news. In the ongoing discussion of the concentration camps being run by our government to hold minors who were separated from their family at the border, we are learning more and more information about the truly deplorable conditions inside these facilities. So the government is using military bases, including, without a trace of irony, former military bases that were used as concentration internment camps in this country to hold Japanese Americans during World War II. I mean, it military facilities to hold young children. And that is the subject of ongoing litigation. And in particular, the litigation. So we first covered the president's executive order separating families at the border in episode 184, literally 1 year ago, as of this record. As a result, that order, as we told you, was idiotically disingenuous in terms of arguing that it was actually designed, you know, more expeditiously to get families back together again. No one believed that at the time. And in the year since then, that has obviously proven not to be the case. This is a disaster. And it is horrifying. I mean, I remember, you know, under George W. Bush, when we learned that the United States was going to operate a secret offshore prison at Guantanamo Bay for the purpose of torturing suspected terrorists. And that was right. That was a moment that I really felt like that fundamentally violates the, you know, that it was shocking to see something that I thought in a bipartisan way, you know, really crossed party lines of, hey, you know, we're the U.S. We don't torture people. That turned out not to be the case, right? One of the things I coach high school debate again, because my son is now involved. And I coached it for a very, very long time. And, you know, one of the things that is often a high level question, this is a philosophers in space riff. So feel free but one of the sort of recurring questions in high school debate at what we call like the standards, right? The question of how do you evaluate the round are questions of, are moral obligations determined, you know, in a utilitarian fashion, by adding up the benefits and subtract, right? Cost versus benefit analysis, or are they governed by some kind of deontological principle, right? I don't know where you come out on that, right? I've heard you make arguments that sort of fall into both camps.
Well, that's fair. I think everybody does. I think that's really how it goes. I think that you can't ultimately, everything wants to get at consequences. That's why I like consequentialist a little better than utilitarian. Everything, there's no story you tell about morality and moral choices that doesn't bear out in consequences. In fact, the arguments against utilitarianism and maybe consequentialism are themselves argued in forms of consequences, which is why I think ultimately that's what you're going for. But I do think that sometimes there are rules that might shortcut that or might be good rules of thumb in order to bring about consequences, even if in the if in the short term it might seem like, you know, it's counterintuitive. So it's a complex thing, but I think that I definitely lean more toward consequentialism, but just that our limited knowledge can make it difficult to know all the consequences that are going to be borne out forever and to how many people and all that. So that's kind of where I stand on that. What does this have to do with anything? How did we get here?
Well, I'm gonna go there. Sorry, it's a little bit of a rabbit trail. When you are kind of taking the position in a debate round, right, you have to take sort of the strong deontological position, right? Part of what you have to do, part of what the challenge of that is, right? Crafting a rule that like provide, you know, that seems to meet with the conditions of something like Kant's categorical imperative, right? That like is always true no matter what. And we always had two sort of ready go-to answers, right? And one is totally disingenuous, as you will see, right? Which is you shouldn't violate the rights of an innocent person. Right. And like that statement is universally true. But, you know, as you point out, when you unpack the adjectives in there, those adjectives have ends based consequences built into the adjectives. Right. The other statement that we
not only that,
use,
I can think of millions of times every day that we don't hold that to be sacredly true above anything. If the consequences are going to be rough enough, you know, then we violate that. Like if, you know, we do that all the time. I mean,
like what?
Well, for one thing, I mean, you could almost say, to bring it to a law concept, you could almost say eminent domain is kind of that. Like there are times when we think the greater good would necessitate that we kind of violate some rights here and there. We're going to do our best to compensate you for it. But that's how it goes. I mean, certainly there are times when innocent people's rights are trampled because there's a greater benefit that needs to be enacted. I think that, right? I mean, that's Star Trek 101.
Interesting. I would argue eminent domain, right? You when you compensate the person, you've, you know, compensated them for the rights violation. But I see what you're saying.
You don't give them a choice, and you know you.
Yeah.
Anyway.
No, I like that. the whole point of this.
I think you've taken this bonus episode license a little too hard.
I have.
You've really been like, I'm going to stretch out my legs. My podcast legs, I get to say whatever I want. That's Andrew is with no time limit. Here's what you're going to do. You're going to run into a time limit.
Yeah, my point is that the other example that was our go-to was you shouldn't torture people.
Right. Yeah.
Right. That is as close to an absolute side constraint that everybody agreed with.
Absolutely.
Until
yeah.
all of a sudden it was 2001 and we didn't agree with it anymore because it was made partisan. And now, 40%+ of it. When you do polls, right, 40%+ of the country is like, hey, well, enhanced deterioration, that's fine. That's that normalization of something that is that I would argue fits into the conditions of absolute side constraints is truly terrifying. And I don't want to see that happening with respect to the construction of concentration and use of concentration camps in this country for children. I mean, it's unthinkable. And yet we're in the middle of a debate in which the question is the semantics of how children who are being kept in woefully inadequate conditions, the semantics of what we call those things.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, litigation is currently pending in the Ninth Circuit challenging the ICE's holding detaining of minors. The operative legal standard here is actually not a law, but is a settlement of a class action from 1997. It is called the Flores settlement. And it was a class action lawsuit brought by Jenny Lissette Flores on behalf of others similarly situated against Janet Reno, against Bill Clinton's era, what was then referred to as INS, the Immigration and Naturalization Service, pre-9/11 version of ICE. And in 1997, the litigation had been pending for 9 years. So again, how we treat children at the border has been a problem for decades, but we've reached new lows. As a part of that settlement contains an exhibit. It contains multiple exhibits, but exhibit one is the minimum standards for licensed programs. That is places where you can again, Flores anticipates a very, very short turnaround, very temporal, a temporary placement of kids, nothing like what we have today. And it requires that licensed programs shall comply with all applicable child state welfare laws and regulations and all state and local building, fire, health, and safety codes, and shall provide or arrange for the following services for each minor in its care. And I'm just going to go. This is really. I'm going to link it in the show notes. It's extensive. Okay. The things that you must do. There are 14 separate paragraphs. Right. Paragraph one says you must provide proper physical care and maintenance, including suitable living accommodations, food, appropriate clothing, and personal grooming items. And paragraph two says you must provide appropriate and routine medical and dental care, family planning services, which we already know is being violated, and emergency health care services, including a complete medical examination, including screening for infectious disease within 48 hours of admission, excluding weekends and holidays, blah, 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 blah. So that's the operative law. At oral argument to decide whether what the U.S. government is doing is complying with the Flores settlement, the Trump administration argued that it was not required to give soap or toothbrushes to children apprehended at the U.S.-Mexico border, that it is not required to give them a bed, that it can require them to sleep on concrete floors, that it does not have to maintain a certain population density, that they can require them to sleep in overcrowded, and again, these are military facilities, so prison cells. And that they do not have to maintain. And again, you know, it's summer now, but the evidence dates back to the winter. That in some of these cases, the blankets they had were made out of aluminum foil. And the Trump administration said, yeah, we think that is consistent with our obligations under the Flores settlement. Fortunately, the Ninth Circuit appeared very, very skeptical of these claims. I'm going to link the Courthouse News Service is a pretty reliable lawyers write it. And it's exactly what it sounds like. I mean, it's not, you know, I think only lawyers read it, except, you know, now Opening Arguments listeners. Some of the questions asked from the panel, and remember, this is a 3-judge panel at the Ninth Circuit. U.S. Circuit Judge Marsha Berzon says, you're really going to stand up and tell us that being able to sleep isn't a question of safe and sanitary conditions? And then Circuit Judge William Fletcher got in on the action. Are you arguing seriously that you do not read the agreement as requiring to do anything other than what I just described? Cold all night long, lights on all night long, sleeping on concrete floors, and you've got an aluminum foil blanket? I find it inconceivable that the government would say that that is safe and sanitary. So the government responded that the Ninth Circuit should reverse the findings at the district court level because the district court required them to give detainees soap and toothbrushes. That and they said, look, Flores doesn't say we have to give them soap. And this is, and I'm going to quote directly from the government's lawyer, when asked to assume it was left that way and not enumerated by the parties because either the parties couldn't reach agreement on how to enumerate it or it was left to the agencies to determine, to which the Ninth Circuit Judge Fletcher says, or it was relatively obvious, at least obvious enough so that if you're putting people in a crowded room to sleep on a concrete floor with an aluminum foil blanket on top of them, that it doesn't comply with the agreement. It wasn't perfumed soap. It was soap. That's part of safe and sanitary. Are you disagreeing with that? And so this is horrifying. Some of the story has been picked up by other news sources. And, you know, sometimes we tell you that things are alarmist or this is quoting directly from the oral argument. The conditions inside these detention centers are horrific. And I look forward, hopefully by the time this special episode comes out, the Ninth Circuit will have issued an injunction putting a stop to this practice.
Yeah, a couple questions. I mean, first off, this is just outrageous. I absolutely outrageous. I mean, on so many levels, you know, it's one thing to be doing what they're doing, but what are we talking about if we're talking about soap, like a few dollars to their budget? Like, is it, it's one of those, the cruelty is the point thing, I guess, you know, like, yeah. even if you were a hardliner wanting to eliminate as much immigration as possible, I guess, why can't you at least, while you're detaining these people and keeping them out of the country or whatever you're doing, you don't have to be abusive toward them. Like, it's just, they want to make sure that they're so horrible as people that they want to make sure nobody even tries to come here. Is that the goal? Is that must be the point?
It must be the goal, right? I invite, I don't know that we have too many Trump supporting listeners, but you know, you and I want to steel man the other side of the argument. I think the steel man version of the argument is we want to disincentivize illegal border crossings, right? Yeah. I think the version of the
where
argument
where does that
is,
end? I mean, that justifies anything, if apparently.
I think the actual reading of the argument is our base wants us to be cruel and we're going to deliver it to them.
Yeah.
I can't.
So now I want to know, look, we talk a lot about what your obligations as a lawyer are. And we know there's times when you have to defend, somebody has to defend horrible criminals, that kind of thing. Is this the kind of thing where even Mr. Lawyer Pants Andrew Torres, if you were, you know, in a different life, you were just a gun for hire or whatever. Is this the kind of, is there a line where you need to be like, I'm not going to sit here and with a straight face argue that's not, that denying soap and toothbrushes and blankets is in any way permissible? Like, what's the line of ethics for lawyers? I mean, it's got, there's got to be a bar that's slightly higher than this, right?
Yeah. I'm going to tell a slightly related story from when I signed up day one at Covington and Burlington Coat Factory. And there are kind of problems with all of this, but Covington and Burling was well known at the time for representing, among other things, the Tobacco Institute, right? Which now, mm-hmm. it's now called, like, you know, the Council on Air Quality or whatever, right? Like, we moved into it where all of these lobbying groups that used to be like, yeah, we're the council for more lead in your water, are now, you know, they have some sort of
the council for heavier water.
Yeah. More Council substantial. For Water Plus. Yeah. Yeah. But it used to be called TI, right? That the Tobacco Institute. And it was kind of pitched to us this way. It was like, hey, we do work for a pro tobacco lobbying firm. And there were, at our old offices, there were lawyers who did that work who were, right, chain smokers, right? And the tobacco lobby, right? I mean, it was what I said, and yeah, we get it. They do some shady stuff. So nobody has to do any work for TI if you don't want to. Now, keep in mind, and this was, and again, this was said to me explicitly, keep in mind, since lots of young associates refuse to do work for TI,
yeah,
this is a real good way.
Yeah.
you know, to get experience, you know, get more substantive work, because, you know, not everybody wants to do it. I declined to work for TI. I've been very honest, though. I've done, you know, I did work for Bacardi and for a group called the Century Council, which I think used to be called the Alcohol, you know, the Alcohol
Council.
Well,
that's just good.
Yeah. And again, right, that's because people set their moral, right? To me,
yeah,
the conduct of the alcohol industry does not mirror the conduct of the tobacco industry. Your mileage may vary on that.
This is just one of those times where I feel like there's a lot of ways in which the norms, we need the norms are great, and it's sad that a lot of norms are falling. Here's one where I would like the justices to just say, you are being evil. I'm not even going to listen to this argument. I'm not even going to order an injunction. You are going to enjoin yourself. Like, just, you need to stop it. You know this is evil. You're arguing for something evil. I shouldn't even be here. What are we doing here? I mean, come on.
So Judge Berzon, actually, it's kind of funny that you say that. I wasn't going to quote from this, but Judge Berzon actually asked the government's lawyer, have you considered whether you might go back and consider whether you really want to continue this appeal?
Yeah.
So,
which is the lawyer version. That's as close as you get to what I just said.
Yeah. So, yeah. As part of the canon of judicial ethics, you have a requirement to zealously advocate for your client. I cannot imagine any, right? Like, look, they're good people. Most of DOJ right now, right, are good people. They are career prosecutors trying to do their jobs, you know, and we saw that, right? Like, that is, you know, analogously, like the rights demonizing of, you know, Peter Strzok and Lisa Page, you know, notwithstanding, right? Those were, again, FBI, you know, different circumstances, but those were good career public civil servants still trying to do their jobs, you know, knowing that your boss is now a monster. And lots of people, no, you know, nobody, you know, you have options when you're a prosecutor. But, you know, lots of people just want to be a prosecutor, you know? So all of that is my way of saying I cannot imagine having somebody like that you would go forward and conscript somebody into making this argument, right? That you gotta want to make this argument, and somebody did. So
this needs to go right into every campaign ad for the next couple years.
Yeah.
You know, this administration is really arguing that it's a bridge too far to give soap and toothbrushes to children. That's too
and
too
beds
accommodating
and blankets. Yeah, and
blankets.
Yep.
These people. God. Okay. Anyway, so that's how. What's the we? What are we looking for there? So you think there's hopefully there will be an injunction soon.
And I think there will be an injunction.
Hopefully the Supreme Court isn't that evil, that level of evil.
Hopefully, right? Hopefully.
I don't know. Okay, well, we'll see. All right, what's our next wild card topic? It's the wild card
episode. Our next
wild
card topic. Hopefully this is more fun. This is a topic I have wanted to revisit for a very, very long time. We last covered it in episode 75, and that is the question of non-compete clauses. So I'm going to read a little bit. This is a question we received at our email, openarguments@gmail.com, from Aaron McCullough, who says, I can't get into specifics, but let's pose a hypothetical that an ice cream parlor had a longtime employee, a general manager, let's say, leave the company and form her own gelato shop. While it's not technically ice cream, there'd be a reasonable expectation that her new gelato shop would be in direct competition with her former employer's ice cream parlor. And let's say that when
well, that's
she
no
first
competition. Gelato wins, yeah, hands down.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Vote, yeah.
And let's say that when she first started working for a previous employer, she signed a non-compete agreement that specifies that any employee is not allowed to enter into direct competition with that employer for 2 years in a 25-mile radius of the ice cream parlor. Would the agreement be legally enforceable? So I love the question. And let me first make this super, super clear, because I'm guessing that the hypothetical may map into reality in some ways. Number one, don't take legal advice from a podcast. And number two, look, this is super critical in this case because, as we're about to explain, different states mm-hmm. have different rules regarding how they enforce non-compete.
Okay, yeah, about non-compete.
Also regarding gelato, but regarding how they enforce non-competes. So, for example, Thomas, the state you live in, California, has a statute, as was then interpreted by the state Supreme Court. I used to say recently, but I guess it's now about 10 years old, that they won't enforce it at all.
Wow.
But with certain very, very extreme exceptions. And that's really, really interesting. So in other words, you can sign a contract in California, and again, don't take legal advice from this podcast, that says, you know, you will not work for X employer. After the term of your employment, you will not work for anybody else or start a business that is in competition, within a 20-mile radius for 2 years. And in many, many cases, you can go out tomorrow and be in competition, right? Even if you've signed an agreement to the contrary. And the reason has to do with Silicon Valley, right? It has to do with the tech industry in California, because the way in which tech startups operate now is they go find go-getter middle managers at Google, at Apple, whatever, and say, hey, how'd you like to come join this new startup and we'll give you tons of equity and, you know, maybe you'll become a millionaire someday, right? And so they hire them away by offering them more money and the promise of way more money. And so what makes that super interesting is that now you have a robust body of economic literature suggesting that non-competes are bad for business, right? And that changes the dynamic of the argument, right? Because for 100 years in this country, the idea was non-competes are good for the business and bad for the individual, right? And so to the extent that it you could predict kind of on political ground, you'd be like, okay, so liberal states, liberal Supreme Court, you know, more pro-individual Supreme Court are going to be anti-non-competes. More pro-business states are going to be pro-non-compete. And the California model really kind of throws that on its head and says, look, there are pro-business reasons to be skeptical of non-compete agreements. And as a result, states following the California model, either through legislation, and a bunch of states have tried to curb non-compete agreements through legislation, or through state Supreme Court opinions reinterpreting how non-competes are enforced, are considering and weighing in on these kinds of arguments, right? So, you know, and I'm going to talk about kind of the standard law in just a minute, but like there have been opinions in Idaho, Missouri, and Florida, right? Like, you know, pretty red states that are pretty skeptical of non-competes. So keep that one in mind. In general, the way in which you approach, in which 45 states approach whether to enforce a non-compete agreement is a balancing test. It is called the legitimate business interest test, or LBI. And it basically goes like this. First, you have to establish that there is a legitimate business purpose in restricting the employee from working, right? And I don't want to be in competition with you is not a legitimate business interest, right? Right? Again, libertarian paradise. We live in a capitalist economy. You know, you make better widgets. Well, right. Go out, start your own widget factory. Now, let's go back to the ice cream example. What might be a legitimate business interest? Well, you've learned how to make ice cream by working for me. And now you're stealing my proprietary business stuff and you're using it against me. And so I need, as an employer, to know that my proprietary stuff is safe. So I want to restrain you from going into competition against me where there might be an inference that you are taking something that we want to incentivize people doing in the first place, right? And there, like, I think the ice cream versus gelato shop probably does pass the sniff test on that, right? Mm-hmm. I could see a court going, yeah, no, look, like, you're going to learn, maybe gelato is different than ice cream, but you probably learn recipes, flavor combinations, you learn how to market, right? And we want that first ice cream shop to go into business. And so if they wouldn't go into business, if everybody who comes along is going to steal the model and replicate, right? So to incentivize them to go into business in the first place, we're going to say that they do have a legitimate business interest in something. That's kind of step one. And let me point out, lots and lots of people, again, don't take legal advice from a podcast. There was a report that one of the big box stores, I'm going to say Target. I don't know if it was Target. Please, Target, if you're listening, don't sue me. But one of the big box stores had its baggers and cashiers sign non-compete agreements, right? And say, hey, we're not going to go. I promise I'm not going to work.
You've learned this valuable bagging technique that can't be replicated and stolen from us.
Yeah. And that's garbage, right? That is obviously not a legitimate business interest. And remember,
most other stores try to put the bag on top of the stuff, but you know the secret. Put the stuff in the bag.
Don't eat the bag. That would not pass the straight face test. There is no legitimate business interest in protecting against someone who, you know, isn't learning valuable skills or client content or whatever, right? And remember the flip side. And again, you don't have to be a crazy lefty state to see this. The flip side is a non-compete prevents somebody from being a valuable part of the economy, right? Like it says, we are, you know, preventing you from earning your livelihood. So that's a real cost. So the step one is there a legitimate business interest? And then step two, if there isn't, you're out, right? The clause is just gone. But if there is, step two, then the court has to.
Then there's more tests after that.
Yeah. Has to balance all of the respective interests that are at stake here. And typically, there are five criteria that a state will use in figuring out if a non-compete clause is reasonable. Once there's a, once it's established that there is a legitimate business interest. And those criteria are, number one, the duration of the clause. Number two, the geographical scope of the clause. Number three, the degree to which the clause is necessary to protect the employer. Number four, the degree to which the clause is a restraint on the employee's right to pursue work. And number five, the interference in the public interest. And those are pretty straightforward, right? The two biggest are obviously one and two, right? So, you know, you work for my ice cream parlor, and then I say for 5 years, you can't work for any ice cream parlor anywhere in the United States, right? That's ridiculous. You know, what if I move from, you know, Connecticut to Idaho? Like, you know, I could steal your business 100% and who cares, right? Like that Idaho business is not competing with the neighborhood ice cream parlor in, you know, Waterbury, Connecticut, right? And same thing for duration. So presumptively, things like you will see in non-compete clauses, you will see a geographical scope. It will be like within a 20-mile radius of the business's headquarters in, you know, Waterbury, Connecticut. And same thing for duration, right? Excessively long time periods, you know, it's sort of like, look, businesses change and adapt. And, you know, if you can't deal with it after a certain period, then, you know, maybe you're just not a good business person. Different states differ on this, but generally every state I know of will hold that at least 6 months is a reasonable duration for the average non-compete clause. Many states will allow up to 2 years. So somewhere in that 6 month to 2 years is probably presumptively good. Anything less than 6 months is definitely good. Anything over 2 years is almost certainly bad, right? It's almost certainly no
good. Gotcha.
And we'll talk about what no good means in a minute. And then the rest of it is, you know, sort of looking at specific stuff, right? So, you know, let's go back to the Target bagger case. If I say something that might otherwise be a totally fair geographic scope, right? You can't do it within 20 miles of any of our stores, right? And let's say I've got three crab restaurants, right? Or three ice cream parlors. You know, you can't open an ice cream parlor within 20 miles of any of our stores. Okay, well, that's fair. Well, what if I say you can't be in competition with Target within 20 miles of any Target store, right?
Everywhere.
You know, there are thousands of Target stores in the country. So that's why you have the additional criteria of, you know, how much does this protect the employer? How much does it restrict the employee? Does it serve the public interest? It's ways of looking at the specifics and going, okay, this might otherwise be reasonable, but, you know, in this circumstance, you know, it's not reasonable. And then, you know, the public interest is, you know, suppose you run a blood bank, right? Like, you know, you're right. It's you could imagine situations where we would go, we want
more of that. That's
yeah.
We don't want big blood taking over monopoly on
right. So now, and then, you know, bring the segment to a close, but just because if your non-compete could be found valid, could be found invalid, to bring kind of the segment to a close, if a non-compete is found invalid, there are essentially three different things that a court can do in response to an invalid provision in a contract. And this, again, this varies state by state, right? So the first thing that they can do is they can just strike out the entire covenant not to compete, right?
Do you pop in that severability clause thingy that you always talk about where you're like, any part of this can be stricken from the thing or whatever.
Yeah.
Without.
No, that's right. And so this is lawyers call this red penciling, right? From the days where you actually used a pencil, but the court can just be like, same contract, everything's going to be enforced, but we're just striking this whole thing out. Alternatively, so that's one option. And it just means, you didn't comply with the balance of interests, made it, you know, it was for too long. You said for 3 years, and within 50 miles, and that's just too far. So we're going to strike the whole thing out. So the second thing is called blue penciling. And so what the court can do is, cross out only the provisions of the clause that render it unenforceable. Right. So, now let's change our clause a little bit, and let's say, suppose that a non-compete clause in a jurisdiction that, you know, otherwise follows the LBI test says you may not take a job with our competitors that competes or otherwise within, you know, 20 miles and for 2 years, right? And let's say that the court determines that the legitimate business interest that you were working in a tech capacity for employer A, for the first employer, and then you went off to go be in a sales capacity for employer B, and employer B is a competitor of employer A, but you're not going to use any of the tech stuff that you learned with employer B, right? The court might say, look, this covenant not to compete is too broad because you're saying somebody who worked for you in a tech capacity is now prohibited from working in any capacity with your competitors, right? It says whether competing or otherwise. So what we're going to do is we're going to blue pencil out whether and or otherwise, right? So now what it's left with is you may not work for a competitor in a competing, you know, in a competing job, right, in the same job, but we're going to scratch out the or otherwise. And so the covenant remains in effect. So this guy, you know, if he leaves and it's still running for, you know, another year and a half. So if he leaves employer B and goes to employer C and tries to take a tech job with another competitor, right, he's still bound by that. But we're going to relieve him of the unenforceable obligation in the covenant not to compete. So in other words, instead of red penciling the whole covenant and going, guess what? You're a free agent. You can work for whoever you want, doing whatever you want, because your employer rolled the dice, tried to ask for too much and failed. The blue pencil doctrine is a bit more employer friendly. It says if it can be salvaged, then by crossing out the offending provisions, then we will salvage it in that way. But it wouldn't solve, right? If suppose the problem is the non-compete says you can't compete within 100-mile radius for 5 years, right? And the court says that the geographic scope is too far and the time period is too long. Then you can't save that through blue penciling either, right? Because there are no words that you can cross out that will leave that clause in effect unless you get to the third set of states, which allow for what we call equitable reformation of the contract. And that is where the court can say, look, you as an employee were willing to sign on to a contract that says you can't work for 5 years and you can't work within 50 miles. That's too far as a matter of law. That contract is unconscionable and void as a matter of public policy. But we're not going to let you off the hook. We're just going to rewrite that down to the maximum standards that our law allows.
And yeah.
That's
what I was going to ask, because I was like, early on, I was thinking if you just cross out like the time threshold, then it makes it kind of meaningless. You'd need to like you'd have to have, you know, there's like parameter missing, you know, like you can't within blank time. Like, well, what does that mean? So there is an option to actually revise to it down to an acceptable parameter of any of these things.
Yeah. That's right. And that equitable reformation, right, where you scratch out 5 years and you write in 6 months, again, under the theory that, look, if you agreed to 5 years, you definitely agreed to 6 months, is the law in about 30 different jurisdictions. So most states that permit non-compete clauses will sort of bend over backwards and enforce the contract to the extent of the law, even if it's overly generous on the part of the employer. Only three states are red pencil doctrines that I know of. And weirdly enough, so right, so the red pencil doctrine is the one that is the most employee favorable, right? That says, nope, employer tried to grab too much, so we're going to strike out the whole clause. You want to take a guess what those three states are? You will never guess, but
I will. Hawaii, Alabama, and the territory of Puerto Rico. No, you said I'd never guess, so I was just going wild.
I love you're actually like reasonably close, right? And I mean that alphabetically. Those three jurisdictions are
very meaningful:
Arkansas, Nebraska, and Virginia.
Oh, okay.
And again, I think this illustrates kind of the weird state of non-compete law, right? Like those right, you have a blue a newly blue state with significant rural areas in Virginia. You have the utterly unpopulated state of Nebraska, and you have the formerly blue, now deep red,
Nebraska.
Southern
like, do we want to do this non-compete? Yeah, who can, it doesn't. What does it matter?
There aren't any businesses in Nebraska.
Flip a coin. So. Yeah, either not. We'll be either way on this. It doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. Just either way. Pick a. And so That's the story of Nebraska.
So I love being able to do this this deep dive. I litigate these kinds of cases. I just want to end as we're answering Aaron's question that I do not think, and again, there's a self-interest involved here, but I don't think you can reasonably answer a question by Googling, talk to a lawyer. It shouldn't be overly expensive to get an opinion about the enforceability of your contract. I go through this segment to show you that there's so many considerations, right? Does your state enforce it at all? If it does it apply the LBI test? If it does, is there any, is there any guidance as to whether there's a legitimate business interest?
Yeah.
If it does, what counts as geographic scope? What counts as time? Yeah. Right?
Do you live in Nebraska? So are there even people where you are? That's another.
Exactly. But I thought it was pretty fascinating.
Yeah.
And I know.
So I think what you're saying is go to LegalZoom.com and, right?
Yeah. Then kill yourself. Don't take it. Don't do either of those.
I do want to ask you though. You referenced that Silicon Valley is something to do with this. I was thinking like so much of this is like a place, a type of distance based thing. Like the internet obviously would throw all that away. How do you write a clause or enforce a clause or whatever in a era where so much business is online and there's no distance doesn't matter.
Yeah, and the answer is non-compete law is not remotely caught up to business on the internet, and in a way that that fails to protect legitimate business interests over the internet. So what I advise my clients to do, and what I think most smart lawyers are doing, is figuring out ways to protect those legitimate business interests by calling them stuff other than blunderbuss kind of broad covenants not to compete, right? So if you identify things as confidential information, right, and you specifically designate it, every state will enforce being able to get an injunction, a nationwide injunction against somebody that uses your confidential information, right? If you have customer lists, and again, don't take.
So you're saying just try to protect the individual elements that you're trying
exactly
to protect,
exactly right.
Rather than trying to have this sort of totalitarian control over the human that you're saying can't work somewhere else.
Exactly right.
Okay,
and it is right. My prediction as a result that within 10 years, most states will disfavor kind of these broad non-competes. I think that's where the law is going. And I think that it's going to get there because of the practices that I've described, right? It's just, and look, I think that's going to be a good thing, right? Like it's going to force employers to say, now this is what we care about, right? We have a proprietary mechanism for doing X and we don't want you to steal X. And those lawsuits
that seems
will,
fair to me.
Seems fair to me too. So that's where I think we're headed.
All right. Well, Good old deep dive, an old timey deep dive, everybody. Oh, takes us to the days of yore, back before Trump, when we could just deep dive into these legal issues.
Oh, I love it. This is. I can't wait for President Warren when we can do this, you know, all the time.
Yeah. I think we may need to, by the way, first of all, I've said this to you, and I can't remember if I've said this on the show. If Elizabeth Warren is elected president, I'm going to make an episode's worth of Andrew Was Right. Like, I'll put in the word, it's worth it to me. Like, this is one of those hedging my bets in a way that's just, yes, I'm setting myself up for having to do a bunch of work that, you know, I really don't need to do, but it's so worth it to me. We need to make a supercut of Andrew saying, now I may have to crowdsource this a little bit because we have a billion episodes, but like, of just all the times you said future president, you know, Elizabeth Warren, and just make the ultimate Andrew Was Right episode, because it'll be the best Andrew Was Right. But also, in addition to that, if we get President Warren, we may need to turn, I mean, Yodel Mountain is forever, because who knows how long it's going to take to, you know, unravel all that and to keep up with who was and wasn't punished for all the stuff they did, all that stuff. And also, Yodel Mountain can stand in for government corruption in general. It doesn't doesn't have to be Trump necessarily. But we may need another segment of like fixing the damage. I don't know what Price is Right game show this would be, but like just all the ways in which we need to undo or fix or reverse or whatever it is, a thing that I'm guaranteeing will be under the radar because there's just too much to even keep track of. So in addition, it won't, what I'm saying is it's not going to be all historical deep dives. Like, there's going to be lots of stuff we still need to talk about in the here and now, but just in a different way.
And look, like, there will be bad rulings at the state, right? I mean, like,
the Supreme Court will still be horrible.
The Supreme Court will still be horrible. So, you know, we've got job security. Don't worry about that. I really do look forward to the days in which this show can be dedicated to, like, here's how we fix stuff. Here's why the law means stuff again.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
You know, Optimus Prime.
The ultimate, I was going to say, the ultimate rise of Optimus Prime.
There we go.
He was sure he was frozen under the sea for a while. Or was that the other one? Either way,
that was the other one.
That's fine, but now it's Optimus' turn to be frozen under the sea for exactly four years, and then when Warren is elected, then Optimus Prime can unfreeze and go be Optimus Prime again. All right, let's talk about the last thing you wanted to talk about. We're gonna get through it all because we've specifically made time for it. Yeah. Let's do an Andrew Was Right and an Andrew Was Wrong on the Hatch Act.
I'm asking you if you know the difference between right and wrong.
Maybe. Maybe not. Maybe yourself.
Yeah, I'm going to read most of this comment. This is from Adam Kerrigan, who says, great episode commentary regarding the Hatch Act. So compliment sandwich coming. I'm always a good way to make sure you get on the show. He says, I have some comments. Some of the information you put out to the extent to which federal employees can participate in partisan elections was potentially misleading. You are absolutely correct that the interpretation of the Hatch Act has become considerably looser over the past 30 years, but it doesn't get quite as loose as it sounded like you were describing. True, we can participate in partisan political campaigns. We can be members of partisan political clubs. We can even, on our own time, be officers of those partisan political clubs. However, we cannot run for any form of partisan political office. That's true. And that error came about because I was describing the basis for one of the plaintiffs in one of the earlier Hatch Act suits was labor organizers who wanted to run for office. And I went back and listened to the episode. It definitely sounds like I said that the amendments to the Hatch Act that got rid of some of the other stuff also got rid of that. And that's not the case. Mm-hmm. So I appreciate that clarification. It was misleading and it's part of why I wanted to do this. Back to Adam. Nor can we in any way allow our status as federal employees to give our perspective or comments any kind of additional standing. And this here he goes through and talks about during uncompensated versus compensated time. I totally agree. This is what I think I was saying. So yeah, this would be like the example I think I gave on the episode of, you know, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff appears in his military uniform while giving a briefing and says, if you elect Elizabeth Warren, then, you know, North Korea will nuke us, right? Like that would very plainly be compensated on the job time, lending unwarranted credibility to a personal opinion. Otherwise, right, perfectly protected, right? Like that general could believe it. That general could be pro-Trump in his spare time. Mm-hmm. But it is being on the clock in compensated time and invoking his status as a federal employee that triggers the Hatch Act violation. Couple more things that I think are really, really important. I'm super glad that Adam decided to raise this as clarification. This is not necessarily things that I was right or wrong about, but, you know, it's worth going into more depth. The Hatch Act only applies to executive branch employees, right? So, for example, there is a Maryland delegate from Cecil County named Kevin Hornberger. He is elected to public office. He says Republican stuff. He works for the Library of Congress. Library of Congress is not an executive branch agency, so Hatch Act doesn't apply to him. We mentioned this at the start of the segment, but it is worth pointing that out, that you work for, let's say, the clerk of courts, right? Like there are lots of government employees who are not executive branch employees. Most of them are, but there are some that are not, and the Hatch Act does not apply to them. It does not apply to congressional staffers, for example. So that is really good. Other points that Adam makes that I think are really useful. He, you know, verifies our pessimism that this is really going very far. Right? He says, if the president chooses not to follow the Office of Special Counsel's recommendation, the next step would be for OSC to make a choice. It's up to them to decide whether or not to formally bring a charge before the board, the MSPB. If they don't press the issue, it's over. Kellyanne Conway stays, doesn't even get a citation. But if the OSC chooses to pursue a charge, then the OSC functions as the prosecutor before the board. If the board hears the case, it would have the authority to issue a decision on the merits. The board would have the authority to direct the president to terminate, but the MSPB is an executive branch agency. The president is the head of the executive branch, and it's unlikely that he would act in accordance with any board decision he didn't like. Factors to consider. OSC is currently run by a Trump appointee, and as Adam points out, I did point that out in the episode. The MSPB hasn't had sufficient members to constitute a quorum in forever. So they can't make any rulings. There's a huge backlog of cases that would likely need to be heard before Conway's case could even be put on the docket. And the most likely outcome here, if OSC presses the issue, would be the Conway's case wouldn't see the light of day until sometime in late 2020 or early 2021 after the election. And everybody
Negatron wins again, everybody. Yeah. Sternly worded letters, sternly worded letters. That's what we have in this day and age.
Yep. And that's where Adam comes out. He says, most likely course of events, Conway stays. Every other federal employee on his staff learns that they can get away with these kinds of violations. Yep. They ramp up as the election approaches. Once again, we know this is illegal, but there's nothing you can do about it. Becomes the status quo.
I think it's kind of funny to take all this time to be like, no, Andrew, precisely the ways the Hatch Act works is this. Oh, and also it's none of this is enforced and it doesn't matter in any way. I think it's kind of a funny... I mean, I get it. I welcome the information. It's good to know what should be happening, but isn't, I guess.
Well,
still, it's kind of funny to be like nitpicking the description of a thing that doesn't matter because it doesn't exist.
Well, but here's why it does matter.
Get ready, everybody.
For everybody else. It doesn't matter for Kellyanne Conway.
Right, yeah. No, you're right. When we have Democrats in there, we should make sure that we follow the rules.
Yeah.
And
as Adam points out, this is an area where I said kind of cavalierly, Hatch Act prosecutions are rare. And he says, yeah, prosecutions are rare, but that doesn't tell the whole story. You have to consider why they're rare. It's not common for MSPB to hear the cases because supervisors generally listen when the OSC tells them that they have to fire an employee for a Hatch Act violation. Prosecution only comes into play when a supervisor refuses to do what the OSC has recommended or when an employee tries to craft an appeal of a Hatch Act violation. In the latter case, MSPB doesn't have to take the appeal if the OSC argument is strong. Usually, it just shuts down the appeal in the early stages. Almost nobody fights Hatch Act terminations. He says, and I love this phrase, I'm going to start using this, the squeeze isn't worth the juice. takes years to argue a case before the board. Most folks just find another job and chalk it up to experience. Odds are they hated working for the government anyway. Adam then concludes, I don't know that any of this constitutes an Andrew was wrong, but considering and briefly explaining what I'm offered may help people better understand. I totally agree. You put the other slice of bread on the compliment sandwich. So I will take my medicine on what's in between. But no, I thought that I was super useful and I really appreciate it. And I'm glad we got a chance to,
me
to do it
too.
On the show.
I tease, but I do also appreciate it. It's good to be armed with the facts, hypothetical though they may be sometimes. all right. Well, we've done it. We've done a wild card episode. We got to catch up on some stuff. We got to get to some stuff that was both as depressing as it was newsworthy in the Ninth Circuit thing. I'm horrified by that. We need to all stay outraged permanently, really, until this is resolved, which will be maybe never. So permanently, we need to do our best to keep our eye on all these things and keep it in perspective. This really is that bad, you know? This administration is that bad. So let's keep at it. I know I can be negative, but it's because there's so much to be negative about. So,
sorry about
that.
I will continue to be out there. There is so much more, you know, we're at over an hour on the bonus and I could go another hour on bad stuff about Justin Walker. There's a lot of bad stuff out there and let's stay vigilant on that. Don't forget, you know, hashtag oppose Justin Walker. So,
all right. Well, thank you so much for listening. Thanks to our patrons for making this happen. They are the reason this show happened. So if you'd like to join patreon.com/law, they, of course, got access to this episode early, quite early. So that's another reason to join. But thanks so much, patrons. Thanks, listeners. And share this out. If you can't be a patron, we understand that lots of people can't. Make sure you share the show. That's the next best thing to do to support us. So thank you so much. We'll see you on Rapid Response Friday.
You betray the law! Law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the assistance of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, our production assistant, Ashley Smith, and our researcher, Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez and the entire OA Wiki team. Follow them at OA Wiki. And a big thank you to our Facebook group moderators, Alicia Cook, Natalie Newell, Emily Waters, Eric Brewer, and Brian. Check out the Opening Arguments Facebook community. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith for creating the show's theme song, which is used with permission. And in it. Thanks, Pop.
I have a non-compete clause with your dog that it can't bark within 20 miles of this podcast. Sorry, dog.